We were barreling down Route 66 when Little Jim suddenly sat up. "Where am I?" he asked. Rosemary, thinking this was hilarious, burst into laughter, but I was furious. I wanted to take Little Jim to the hospital anyway, but he insisted he was fine and even stood up on the car seat and started dancing around to prove it, which got me even more furious. I'd done all that driving around for nothing, canceling class for no good reason, and I was worried I'd be docked a day's pay. "We're just going to go round up all those kids a second time," I said. "But they've already gone home," Rosemary said. "They'll be out playing and won't want to come back." "I've told you before, life's not about doing what you want." Rosemary looked a little pouty. Then she started saying she didn't feel so well and was dizzy and needed to go home. "Oh, so you're the sick one now," I said.
"That's right, Mommy."
"Well, I'm going to take you to the hospital then," I said.
"I just want to go home."
"Not another word," I said. "If you're sick, you don't need pampering, you need treatment." Whenever she tried to protest, I repeated myself. I drove straight to the Kingman Hospital. After a talk with one of the nurses about a daughter who wanted to play hooky, I arranged for Rosemary to spend the night in a room by herself where she could ponder truth and consequences. If I was going to be docked a day's pay, someone, at the very least, was going to learn a lesson from the experience. "Feeling better?" I asked Rosemary when I picked her up the next day. "Yep," she said. And we both left it at that. But the kid never tried to play hooky again. One Saturday morning that fall, when I went out into the yard, I looked over at the hearse parked next to the barn. It was just sitting there, and that struck me as a real waste. Unlike a horse, a car didn't need a day off every now and then. If I could put the hearse to work for me on the weekends, it would, after gas, be pure profit. I decided to start up a taxi service. On the side of the hearse, under school bus, I used the same silver paint to add, "And taxi." Jim came up with the idea of strapping some old buggy seats in the back when we had paying passengers. There weren't exactly a lot of people standing by the road trying to hail taxis in that part of Arizona. But there were folks without cars who, from time to time, needed to get to the courthouse in Kingman or be picked up at the train depot in Flagstaff, and they'd hire me. They'd leave word in advance with Deputy Johnson and Seligman, and every day or two, I'd stop by his office to see if I had any customers. Most of the money went into our savings, but I kept some aside for the occasional flying lesson. I was an excellent driver. I didn't particularly like city driving, with all the stoplights and street signs and traffic cops, but out in the country, I was in my element. I knew the shortcuts and the back roads and had no hesitation heading out cross-country, barreling through the sagebrush and startling the roadrunners out of the undergrowth. If we got stuck in a ditch while I was ferrying around the school kids, I had them get out and push while we all chanted Hail Marys. "Push and pray," I'd holler, while gripping the steering wheel and gunning the engine, sand and rock spraying behind the spinning wheels as the car fishtailed its way out of the ditch. My paying passengers were also expected to help push if we got stuck. I didn't make them say Hail Marys, but I used the same line, "Push and pray." When Jim heard it, he said, "Probably should paint that on the hearse, too." One weekend that December, three ladies from Brooklyn were staying with our neighbor, Mrs. Hutter, the woman who cooked the stews for the school and who was their cousin, and they hired me to take them all up to see the Grand Canyon. I stored a picnic lunch in the hearse and brought Rosemary along with me. I expected these Brooklyn gals to be tough and smart, and maybe even practicing socialists. But instead, they were all ninnies who wore too much makeup and kept complaining about the Arizona heat, the hearse's uncomfortable buggy seats, and the fact there was no place in the entire state to get a good egg cream. They had these thick Brooklyn accents, and I had to fight the temptation to correct their atrocious pronunciation. While I tried to keep up a positive line of chatter, pointing out that the town of Jerome was named after Winston Churchill's mother's family, they kept saying things like,
But what do yous people do out here? And how do yous live without electricity? They also kept going on about Christmas in New York, about the tree in Rockefeller Center, the window displays at Macy's, the gifts, the lights, the kids lining up to talk to the red-suited Santas. What's Santa Claus going to bring yous this year? One of the ladies asked Rosemary. Who's Santa Claus? She asked. Yous never heard of Santa Claus? The woman sounded bewildered. We don't pay much heed to that sort of thing around here, I said. Well, that's a crying shame. So who's Santa Claus? Rosemary asked again. St. Nicholas, I said, the patron saint of department stores. Near Picacho Butte, I noticed the emergency brake had been on the entire time, and without saying anything, I reached down and quietly released it. Just then, we came to a long downward slope at the edge of the plateau. The hearse began picking up speed, and when I pressed down the brake pedal, it went all the way to the floor with no resistance. We had no brakes. I started swerving the car on and off the road, hoping the sand and loose gravel on the shoulder would slow us down. The Brooklyn women got all overwrought, telling me to slow down, asking me what was happening, and demanding that I let them out. Stop the car! Now calm yourselves, girls, I said. We just got us a little runaway taxi, but everything's under control. I'll get us out of this. I looked over at Rosemary, who was staring at me wide-eyed, and gave her a big wink to show her just how much fun we were having. The little creature grinned. She was positively fearless, unlike those honking lace panties in the back. But the swerving hadn't slowed the car, and I realized the situation called for more drastic measures. We reached a stretch of the road that was cut into the side of the mountain. On our side, it sloped down, and on the far side, it rose upward. Ready for some hijinks? I shouted. I am, Rosemary said. But the Brooklyn ladies continued to wail. Hang tight, I shouted. I cut the car across the road and angled up the hillside, bouncing over holes and rocks. But the slope was steep, and while we started losing momentum, we also started tipping sideways, and then the car rolled once, landing upside down, exactly like I'd planned. We got knocked around a bit, but no one was seriously hurt, and we all scrambled out through the open windows. The Brooklyn ladies were in a tizzy, cussing my driving and threatening to sue or have me arrested and my license revoked. Yous almost got us killed! All that's happened to you is that you've had the lace knocked off your panties, I said. Instead of carrying on, you should be thanking me because my driving skills just saved all your necks. You ride, you got to know how to fall, and you drive, you got to know how to crash. Those Brooklyn broads were a bunch of sissies, but they got me thinking about Christmas. For the most part, pioneers and ranchers didn't have the time or money for gift-giving and tree-trimming, and they tended to treat Christmas like Prohibition, another Eastern aberration that wasn't of much concern to them. A couple of years back, when some missionaries were trying to dazzle the Navajos into converting, they had a gift-bearing Santa Claus jump out of a plane, but his parachute didn't open, and he landed with a thud in front of the Indians, convincing them, and most of the rest of us, that the less we had to do with jolly old Saint Nick, the better off we'd be. Still, I got to wondering if maybe I was depriving my kids of a special experience. And that week, I bought some of those fancy new electric Christmas lights in Kingman, and a couple of small toys from Commercial Central, the general store in Seligman. On Christmas morning, I had Jim secretly climb up on the roof and start shaking a string of old carriage bells while I explained to the kids that it was Saint Nick and his flying reindeer visiting all the children in the world, bringing them toys that he and his elves in the North Pole had spent the year making. Rosemary's expression went from bewildered to doubtful. Then she started shaking her head and grinning. What are you talking about, Mom? She asked. Any dummy knows deer can't fly. The deer are magic for crying out loud, I said. I explained that Santa Claus himself is magic.
And that was how he was able to visit every child in the world, leaving them all gifts and socks in the course of one evening. Then I held up two socks and passed them over to Rosemary and little Jim. Rosemary pulled out an orange, some hazelnuts, a roll of Lifesavers, and a small packet with a set of jacks inside. "These aren't from the North Pole," she said as she examined the jacks. "These are from Commercial Central. I saw them there." I walked over to the window and stuck my head out. "Come on down, Jim," I hollered. "They're not buying it." Even though I couldn't sell the kids on Santa Claus, they were beside themselves with excitement about the Christmas lights. We drove up into the hills and cut down a short pine that the kids picked out. Jim dug a hole in the front yard, and we set it in that, tamping down the dirt and stringing the lights around its branches. All afternoon, Rosemary and little Jim danced around the tree and shouted at the sun to hurry up and set. Once it grew dark, we called the cowboys out from the bunkhouse, and Jim pulled the hearse up next to the tree. He opened the hood, attached a cable to the battery, and as we all stood in a circle around the tree, he raised the cable and the light cord above his head, and with a flourish, brought them together. The tree burst into color, and we all gasped at the red, yellow, green, white, and blue lights boldly glowing in the cold night, the only lights for miles around in the immense darkness of the range. "It's magic!" Rosemary shrieked. A number of the ranch hands had never seen electric lights, and a few of them took off their hats and held them over their hearts. "And those Brooklyn broads thought we didn't know how to celebrate Christmas in style." In my second year at Peach Springs, I had 25 students in my one-room schoolhouse. Six of them, almost a quarter of the class, were the children of Deputy Johnson, a raw-boned chain smoker who wore an old fedora and had a droopy mustache. For the most part, I liked Deputy Johnson. He turned a blind eye to minor infractions and tended to give folks the benefit of the doubt as long as they acknowledged that he was the law, deciding what was right and wrong. But he could come down on you hard if you took issue with him. He had a total of 13 children and, their daddy being one of the county lawmen, they did pretty much as they pleased, letting air out of people's tires, throwing cherry bombs down outhouse holes, and leaving the babysitter tied to a tree all night. One of the deputy's sons was Johnny Johnson, who was a couple of years older than Rosemary. He'd been a handful ever since I started teaching at Peach Springs. Maybe it was because he had older brothers who sat around telling dirty stories about girls, but Johnny couldn't keep his hands off them, a regular tomcat in the making. He'd kissed Rosemary on the mouth, something I learned a few days later from one of the other students. Rosemary said it was just a yucky thing that had happened, nothing she wanted anyone to get in trouble over. Johnny, for his part, called Rosemary and the other student lying finks and said I couldn't prove anything. It wasn't worth holding a court of inquisition over, but I was still simmering about the matter a couple of weeks later when, one day during class, the little punk reached over and stuck his hand up the dress of a sweet Mexican girl named Rosita. That boy needed to be taught to keep his grimy hands to himself. So I put my book down, walked up to him, and slapped him hard in the face. He looked at me bug-eyed with shock, and then he reached up and slapped my face. For a second, I was speechless. A smile started creeping across Johnny's face. That little squirt thought he had the best of me. It was then that I hauled him up and threw him against the wall, backhanding him again and again, and when he cowered down in a ball on the floor, I grabbed my ruler and started wailing his butt. "You'll be sorry," he kept screaming. "You'll be sorry." I didn't care. Johnny Johnson needed to learn a lesson he'd never forget, and you couldn't spell it out on the blackboard. You had to beat it into him. Also, he was clearly in danger of becoming a crumb bum heel like my first husband and the producer who seduced Helen, and he needed to realize there could be consequences for mistreating girls. So I kept welling on him, maybe even beyond the call of duty, and truth be told, I got more than a little satisfaction from it. Just as I expected, Deputy Johnson showed up at the school the next day. I'm not here to have a conversation, he said. I'm here to tell you, keep your hands off my boy. Got it? You deputies may think you run Yavapai County, but I run my classroom, I said. And I'll discipline wayward kids as I see fit. Got it? When Jim came home that night, I told him what had happened. This is getting almost predictable, he said. What are you talking about? I said. These showdowns. It's becoming a pattern. It would be either a pattern of me standing up for myself or a pattern of me getting pushed around. Deputy Johnson couldn't get me fired outright, since they'd have trouble replacing me in the middle of the school year. But a few months later, I received another one of those blasted letters saying my contract was not going to be renewed. At this point, I'd practically lost count of the number of times I'd been fired, and I was getting pretty sick of it. The day the letter arrived, I sat at the kitchen table thinking about my situation. If I had to do it all over again, I'd have done the same thing. I wasn't in the wrong. The rules were. I was a darn good teacher and had been doing what was necessary, not only for Rosita, but also for Johnny Johnson, who needed to be reined in before he wound up in serious trouble. Even so, I'd been booted once again, and there was nothing I could do about it. As I sat there brooding about all this, Rosemary walked into the kitchen, and when she saw me, a look of alarm swept her face. She started stroking my arm. "Don't cry, Mom," she said. "Stop it. Please stop it." It was only then that I realized tears were running down my cheeks. I remember how disturbed I'd been as a little girl, watching my mother cry. Now, by letting my own daughter see me all weak and pitiful, I felt that I'd failed her in a big way, and I was furious with myself. "I'm not crying," I said. "I just got dust in my eyes." I pushed her hand away. "Because I'm not weak. You'll never have to worry about that. Your mother is not a weak woman." And with that, I headed up to the woodpile and went on a tear splitting logs, setting each one up on the chopping block and using every ounce of strength I had to bring the axe down on it, sending the split pieces of white wood flying apart while Rosemary stood watching. It was almost as satisfying as wailing Johnny Johnson. Deputy Johnson made sure everybody knew I'd been let go, and he also made no secret as to who was behind it. When I ran into people at the Commercial Central, they figured they couldn't ask me how things were going at school, the way they usually did, and there were awkward silences that everyone who's been given the boot knows all too well. But I was bound and determined to show folks that Deputy Johnson hadn't broken my spirit, and I was looking for a way to do that when it was announced that a special premiere of Gone with the Wind would be held in Kingman. I decided to attend in the fanciest dress this county had ever seen. Gone with the Wind was by far and away my favorite book after the Bible, and I thought it had about as many lessons in it. I'd read it when it first came out, then I'd sat down and read it again. I'd also read most of it aloud to Rosemary. Scarlett O'Hara was my kind of gal. She was tough, she was sassy, she knew what she wanted, and she never let anything or anyone get in her way. Like most people in the country, I'd been looking forward to the movie for years. It was the most expensive movie ever made, shot entirely in Technicolor, and magazines and newspapers had been following all the details of the casting and production. Now that it was finally finished, the studio was holding premieres around the country, including the one in Kingman, and charging $5 for a ticket, an astronomical amount compared to the nickel that a ticket usually cost. Women were expected to wear gowns, and men to wear tuxedos, or at least their Sunday best, to the premiere. Since I'd never owned a gown and wasn't about to splurge on one, the ticket being enough of an extravagance, I decided that I'd take my inspiration from Scarlett herself. I'd fashion my own gown using the living room curtains. The way I saw it, having curtains in the bedroom made sense, but you didn't really need them in the living room. Those red velvet curtains I'd bought with the S&H green stamps were just hanging there in the living room at Hackberry, gathering dust and starting to fade from the Arizona sun. And red was my favorite color. My gown wasn't going to be the sort of fitted, wasp-waisted getup that Scarlett had to be laced into. It would be floor length, but simple and free-flowing. More Grecian than antebellum. I borrowed a sewing machine from my neighbor, Mrs. Hutter, who was an accomplished seamstress. She helped me design the pattern and assisted in the fittings, but I did all the actual sewing. For a belt, I used the curtain sash. I didn't have a full-length mirror, but I could tell when I finished it and put it on for the first time that the gown was, quite frankly, a masterpiece. "You look like a movie star," Rosemary said. "That's a lot of dress," Jim said. "They'll sure see you coming." Jim refused to go to the premiere with me. He had no use for movies. We'd been to a few westerns, and he actually walked out of a couple of them, completely disgusted by what he considered to be the phony depiction of cowboy life, the way movie cowboys sat by the campfire singing after a supposedly rough day on the trail, the way they hung around the corral doing rope tricks instead of mending fences, the way they wore clean white hats and fringy vests and fluffy sheepskin chaps, and most of all, the way they jumped from rooftops onto their horses. "That's not the way it is at all," Jim said. "Course it's not," I told him. "Who would pay good money to see an actual smelly cowboy? You go to movies to escape from the way things really are." "I guess gangsters complain about gangster movies too," he said. But Jim agreed to be my Gone with the Wind chauffeur. And the night of the premiere, he drove me in the hearse, a little dented after the crash with the Brooklyn Broads, into Kingman. When we pulled up to the theater, spectators were milling around on the sidewalk, watching everyone arrive in their finery. Deputy Johnson stood out front in his uniform, directing traffic. Jim got out and opened the hearse door for me, and I stepped onto the red carpet, waving grandly to the crowd and to Deputy Johnson as the photographer's flashbulb popped. Chapter 7. The Garden of Eden. I told Rosemary and Little Jim that I didn't want them making friends with the other school kids, because if they did, those kids would expect special treatment from me. Even if they didn't, the other students might believe that they had if they got good grades. "I have to be like Caesar's wife," I told Rosemary and Little Jim. "I have to be above suspicion." We were also pretty isolated on the ranch, there being no other kids within walking distance. But Rosemary and Little Jim got along fine by themselves. In fact, those two little scamps were each other's best friend. After morning chores, if there was no school, they were free to do whatever they wanted. They loved to rummage around in all the outbuildings. Once they found a couple of old whalebone corsets in a trunk in the garage and wore them around for weeks. They also hiked out to the Indian graveyard, collected arrowheads, swam in the dam and the horse troughs, threw their pocket knives at targets, and worked in the blacksmith shop, heating up pieces of metal and, on one occasion, fashioning something they called the Wagon Wheel Express. Two wagon wheels with an axle and a central iron tongue that they'd welded to the axle and that dragged behind the wheels. They'd pull the Wagon Wheel Express to the top of hills and sit on the tongue as the contraption barreled down. What they loved most of all was riding. Both of them had been on horseback since before they could walk and rode as naturally as any Indian kids. The Palms, in gratitude to Jim for his success with the ranch, had sent Rosemary and Little Jim a Shetland pony. It was the meanest creature on the whole place, always wanting to unhorse whoever was on him. But Rosemary had great fun trying to hang on as the Shetland bucked away or veered under a low-hanging branch, hoping to knock her off. Most days, she and Little Jim saddled up Socks and Blaze, two chestnut quarter horses, and set out into the range. One of their favorite pastimes was racing the train. A set of tracks for the Santa Fe Railroad cut across the ranch, and every afternoon they'd wait for the 2:15. When it came chugging up, they'd gallop alongside it, the passengers leaning out and waving and the engineer sounding the whistle until the train inevitably pulled ahead. It was a race they never minded losing, and then return hot and sweaty with the horses all lathered up. The kids took their share of knocks. They were always falling out of trees and off roofs and horses, getting scraped and bruised. But Jim and I never put up with any tears. "Tough it out," we'd always tell them. They rolled boulders down hills at each other. They ate horse feed and piss ants on dares. They fired at each other with slingshots and BB guns. Cattle charged them and horses stepped on their toes. Once when Rosemary and Little Jim were playing in the pond, he stepped into a sinkhole and was sucked underwater. Big Jim, who was working on the dam, dove in without taking off his boots. He kept plunging down to the pond floor, feeling around for Little Jim, and finally found one of his arms sticking up through the muck. He pulled Little Jim's limp body to the side and, with Rosemary kneeling beside him, kept squeezing on Jim's chest until the muddy water upgushed out of his mouth and he started gasping for air. One day in the middle of the summer when Rosemary turned 8, she and I were driving off-road across the Colorado Plateau in the pickup, bringing supplies out to Jim and some of the hands who were riding the northern fence line checking for breaks. Since it had rained a few days earlier, a mudflat we had to cross was soggier than I'd expected, and darned if we didn't get stuck. We tried pushing but couldn't budge her. I didn't relish the 5-hour walk in the hot sun back to the ranch house, and as I leaned against the hood trying to figure my options, I noticed a herd of wild horses grazing in a copse of cottonwoods about a quarter mile off. "Rosemary, we're going to catch us a horse," I said. "How, Mom? We don't even have a rope." "Just you watch." In the back of the pickup was a sack of feed for the ranch hands' horses and a bucket with some rusting fence nails in it. I emptied the nails onto the flatbed and poured some feed into the bucket, dumping the rest next to the nails. Then I cut the empty feed back into strips with my pocket knife, tied them together, and made a small loop with one end. I had me a hackamore. I gave the bucket to Rosemary, and we set out toward the horses. There were 6 of them, and as we drew near, they all raised their heads and looked at us warily, trying to decide if it was time to bolt. They were scruffy little buggers, with chipped hooves, long bedraggled manes, and bite marks on their rumps. But a lot of the horses on the range had been ridden at one point in their lives, and with the right coaxing, could be brought back around. I had Rosemary rattle the grain in the bucket, and when one of the horses, a red mare with black legs, pricked her ears forward at the sound, I knew I had a candidate. I reminded Rosemary of my dad's old rule about keeping your eyes to the ground so the horse wouldn't think you were a predator. Instead of approaching the mare directly, we circled around her, Rosemary rattling the bucket constantly. When we got close, the other horses moved off, but the mare stayed where she was, watching. We turned our backs to her. There was no way we could catch her by chasing her, but I knew if we could get her to approach us, we'd won. The mare took a step towards us, and we took a step away, which encouraged her to take another step. After several minutes of this, she drew close enough to touch, and I had Rosemary hold out the bucket, letting the horse feed a little. Then I slipped the hackamore around her neck. She looked up startled and pulled her head back, but then she understood we had her, and instead of fighting it, she went back to the grain. I let her finish, then had Rosemary give me a leg up and hoisted her aboard behind me. "Mom, I can't believe we caught a wild horse without even a rope," she said. "Once they've tasted grain, they never forget it." Rosemary loved the idea that this wild animal had come up to her so willingly. Once we got back to the ranch, I told her to let the horse go, and she opened the gate, but the horse just stood there. She and Rosemary were both looking at each other, all daffy-eyed. "I want to keep her," Rosemary said. "I thought you wanted all these animals to run free." "I want them to do what they want to do," she said. "This one wants to stay with me." "The last thing we need around here is another half-broke horse," I said. "Smack her on the rump and send her off. She belongs on the range." As much fun as Life Ranch was for the kids, I felt they needed more civilizing than it could provide. Jim and I decided to send them both to boarding school. While they were away, I was finally going to earn that darn diploma, get a permanent teaching job, and join the union, so beetleheads like Uncle Eli and Deputy Johnson couldn't have me fired just because they didn't like my style. Since the hearse was pretty dinged up after the rollover, and because Little Jim had branded the seats with a dashboard lighter, the county let us buy it for a song. We packed it up and I drove the kids south, first dropping Little Jim, who was 8, at a boys' school in Flagstaff, then Rosemary, who was 9, at a Catholic girls' school in Prescott. I sat in the car watching a nun lead her by hand into the dormitory. At the doorway, Rosemary turned around to look at me, her cheek wet with tears. "Now you be strong," I called out to her. I had loved my time at the Sisters of Loretta when I was a girl, and I was sure that as soon as Rosemary got over her homesickness, she'd be fine. "Some kids would kill for this opportunity," I yelled. "Consider yourself lucky." When I got to Phoenix, I found a bare-bones boarding house and registered for a double load of courses. I figured that if I spent 18 hours a day going to class and studying, I could get my degree in 2 years. I loved my time at the university and felt happier than I thought I had a right to be. Some of the other students were astonished at my workload, but I felt like a lady of leisure. Instead of doing ranch chores, tending sick cattle, hauling school kids far and wide, mopping the school floor, and coping with belligerent parents, I was learning about the world and improving my mind. I had no obligations to anyone but myself, and everything in my life was under my control. Rosemary and Little Jim didn't share my enthusiasm for academic life. In fact, they hated it. Little Jim kept running away, climbing over fences and through windows, pulling out nails when the windows were nailed shut, and using tied-together bedsheets to shimmy down from upper floors. He was such a resourceful escape artist that the Jesuit brothers started calling him Little Houdini. But the Jesuits were used to dealing with untamed ranch boys, and they regarded Little Jim as one more rambunctious rapscallion. Rosemary's teachers, however, saw her as a misfit. Most of the girls at the academy were demure, frail things. But Rosemary played with her pocket knife, yodeled in the choir, peed in the yard, and caught scorpions in a jar she kept under her bed. She loved to leap down the school's main staircase and once took it in two bounds, only to come crashing into the mother superior. She was behaving more or less the way she did on the ranch, but what seemed normal in one situation can seem outright peculiar in another, and the nun saw Rosemary as a wild child. Rosemary kept writing me sad little letters about her life. She liked learning to dance and play the piano, but found embroidery and etiquette excruciating, and the nuns were always telling her that everything she did was wrong. She sang too loudly, she danced too enthusiastically, she spoke out of turn, she drew whimsical pictures in the margins of her books. The nuns also complained that she made inappropriate comments, though sometimes she was simply repeating things I'd told her. Once, when she was wondering about the boy who died trying to swing to heaven, I'd said maybe it was for the best because he might have grown up to be a mass murderer. And when she said the same thing to a classmate whose brother had died, the nuns sent her to bed without dinner. Other classmates picked on her. They called her yokel, bumpkin, and farmer's daughter. And when Jim donated 50 pounds of beef jerky to the school, they dismissed it as cowboy meat and refused to eat it. So the nuns threw it away. Rosemary did stand up for herself. One night, she wrote, when she was doing the dishes, a classmate started teasing her about her father. "Your dad thinks he's John Wayne." "My dad makes John Wayne look like a pussy," Rosemary replied, and dunked the girl's head in the dishwater. Good for her, I thought when I read the letter. Maybe she's got a bit of her mother in her after all. In her letters, Rosemary said she missed the ranch. She missed the horses and cattle, missed the ponds and the range, missed her brother and her mom and dad, missed the stars and fresh air and the sound of the coyotes at night. The Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor in December, and everyone at the school, both the students and the nuns, lived in fear. One girl in Rosemary's class had a brother on the battleship Arizona, and when she'd heard it had been sunk, she fell to the floor sobbing. The nuns kept blankets over the windows at night as part of the blackout. People were fearing that Japanese bombers were going to fill the skies over Arizona, and Rosemary said she felt like she couldn't breathe. "Be strong" was all I could think to say when I wrote her back. Be strong. I also corrected the grammar in her letters and returned them to her. I wouldn't have been doing that girl any favors to let those sort of errors go unchecked. Near the end of Rosemary's first year at the academy, I received a letter from the Mother Superior saying that she thought it would be best if Rosemary didn't return for a second year. Her grades were poor and her behavior was disruptive. I had Rosemary tested that summer, and as I suspected, She was plenty bright. In fact, except for math, she tested in the top 5th percentile. All she needed to do was knuckle down and get focused. I wrote the Mother Superior, assuring her of Rosemary's intelligence and pleading for another chance. The Mother Superior reluctantly agreed, but Rosemary's grades and rowdiness got even worse her second year. And when it was over, the Mother Superior's decision was final. Rosemary and the school were not a good fit. Little Jim hadn't done much better. I'd earned my college degree by then, and I took both Rosemary and Little Jim with me back to the ranch. The kids were so happy to be home that they ran around hugging everything. Cowboys, horses, trees. And then they saddled up Blaze and Socks and headed out to open country, quirting their horses into a gallop and whooping like bandits. Now that I had my college degree, I was in demand as a teacher and got a job in Big Sandy, another little town with a one-room school, where I enrolled both Rosemary and Little Jim. Rosemary was delighted not to be returning to the academy. "When I grow up," she told me, "all I want to do is live on the ranch and be an artist. That's my dream." The war was well underway by then, both in the Pacific and Europe. But aside from the shortage of gasoline, it had little impact on our life in the Colorado Plateau. The sun still rose over the Mullione Rim, and the grazing cattle still wandered the range. And while I prayed for the families who put gold stars in their windows because they'd lost sons in the fighting, truth be told, we still worried more about the rains than the Nips and the Nazis. I did plant a victory garden, mostly to be patriotic, since we had all the beef and eggs we could eat. But a green thumb was not among my talents, and between my teaching and ranch work, I never got around to watering the garden much. By midsummer, those tomatoes and melons had withered on the vine. "Don't fret about it, honey," Jim said. "We're ranchers, not farmers." My mother had died back when I was studying in Phoenix. It was blood poisoning that got her, from her bad teeth, and it came on so quick that I didn't have a chance to make it back to the KC before she passed. During the summer after my first year at Big Sandy, I received a telegram from my dad. After Mama died, Buster and Dorothy had put Dad in an old folks' home in Tucson, since he needed nursing and I was too busy studying to help out with his care. But now, Dad said, he was fading fast, and he wanted to be with his family. "You've always been my best hand," he wrote. "Please come get me." It would be a long trip. The government had been rationing gasoline, and we didn't have enough coupons to go the entire distance. But there was no way I was going to let my father die alone in a strange city. "What are you going to do for fuel?" Jim asked. "Beg, borrow, or steal," I said. I traded slabs of beef for coupons with a few of the people I knew in Kingman and added those to what had been issued by the government. We were still short, but I set out in the hearse anyway. I brought along a gas can, a length of hose, and Rosemary, figuring that all be useful. It was the height of summer, a scorching Arizona day that made the roof of the hearse too hot to touch. We headed south, the road wavering in the distance. Rosemary was unusually quiet, staring out the window. "What's the matter?" I asked. "I'm sad for Grandpa." "If you get down, all you need to do is act like you're feeling good, and the next thing you know, you are," I told her, and launched into my favorite song, "Doodly-doo-rah, doodly-ray." Rosemary had her moods, but they never lasted long, and soon enough we were both belting out the tunes. "Deep in the Heart of Texas," "Drifting Texas Sands," "San Antonio Rose," "Beautiful, beautiful Texas." We always stopped to pick up hitchhiking soldiers and made them sing along, but none of them ever had gas coupons, and by the time we reached Tempe, the gas gauge was pushing empty. I pulled into a truck stop and parked next to a couple of long-haul rigs. Then, taking Rosemary by one hand and holding the gas can with the other, I went into the diner. The customers were mostly men wearing sweat-stained cowboy hats, sitting at the counter drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes. A few of them looked up as I walked in. I took a deep breath. "Could I have y'all's attention, please?" I said loudly. "My little girl and I are trying to get down to Tucson to pick up my dying dad, but we're running shy of gas, and if a few of you fellows would be kind enough
to pitch in with a gallon or just a half a gallon. We could make it the next leg of our journey. There was a moment of silence as each man glanced around at the others, waiting to see how the rest of them would respond. And then one nodded, and so did a couple more. And suddenly, it became the right thing for all of them to do. "Sure enough, ma'am," one of them said. "Happy to oblige a damsel in distress," another said. "And if you do run out of gas, old Slim here will push you." By then, they were all chuckling and getting up from their stools, practically falling over one another for the chance to do a good deed. In the parking lot, the men all siphoned off a gallon or so from their own vehicles, and soon enough, we had ourselves almost two-thirds of a tank. I gave each of the men a hug and a kiss, and as we were pulling out, I looked at Rosemary. "We did it, kid," I said. I was grinning, feeling like the cat that drank the cream. Whoever said I couldn't play the lady? We had to stop once more to ask for gas. We had a little problem when a smirker said sure. He'd let me siphon off a gallon if I sucked his hose, but I backhanded him, and we went on to the next truck stop, trusting that most of the men we asked for help would turn out to be gentlemen, and they were. We made it to Tucson the next day. The old folks' home where Dad was staying was really just a ramshackle boarding house run by a woman with a few rooms to spare. "Ain't been able to make out a word of your pa since he got here." Dad was lying on his back in the middle of the bed. We'd visited him and Mom in New Mexico a couple of times, but I hadn't seen him in several years, and he didn't look so good. He was thin, with jaundiced skin, and his eyes had sunk deep into their sockets. He spoke in a croak, but I could understand him as well as I always had. "I've come to take you home," I said. "Won't make it," he said. "I'm too sick to move." I sat down next to him on the bed. Rosemary sat beside me and took his hand. I was proud to see that she was completely undaunted by the old man's state. She'd been sad about her grandpa on the drive down, but now that she was here, she'd risen to the occasion. Regardless of what those nuns thought, the kid had a brain, a spine, and a heart. "Looks like I'm going to die here," Dad said, "but I don't want to be buried here. Promise me you'll take my body back to the KC." "I promise." Dad smiled. "I could always count on you." He died that night. It was almost as if he'd been holding on until I got there. And when he knew he would be buried back on the ranch, he could stop worrying and just let go. The next morning, some of the other men in the boarding house helped us carry Dad's body out to the hearse and put it in the back. I rolled down all the windows before we left. We'd need plenty of fresh air. In the middle of Tucson, we stopped at a street light, and two kids standing on the street corner started yelling, "Hey, that lady's got a dead man in the back." I couldn't get mad, since what they were saying was true, so I just waved and hit the gas as soon as the light turned. Rosemary, however, sank down below her window. "Life's too short, honey," I said, "to worry what other people think of you." In no time, we were out of Tucson and flying through the desert, heading east into the morning sun. I was driving faster than I'd ever driven before. Cars going the other way flashed past, since I wanted to make sure we got back to the ranch before the body started to turn. I figured if we did get pulled over by any police, they'd cut me some slack once they eyed the cargo. I had to stop a couple of times to ask for gas. Seeing as how the drivers might notice the body when they came out to siphon me their gas, I varied the pitch. "Gentlemen," I said, "I got my dad's dead body in the back of my car, and I'm trying to get him home to be buried as quick as possible in this heat." That sure did startle them. One guy almost choked on his coffee, but they were even more eager to help out than the others had been, and we made it to the ranch before the stench became overpowering. We buried Dad in the small stone-fenced cemetery where everyone who had ever died on the ranch was buried. At Dad's request, he was laid to rest wearing his $100 Stetson, the one with a beaded band that had two rattlers from two rattlesnakes Dad himself had killed attached to it. Dad had wanted us to use phonetic spelling on his headstone, but we overruled him on that,
figuring that folks would think we didn't know how to spell. Dad's death didn't hollow me out the way Helen's had. After all, everyone assumed Dad was a goner back when he was kicked in the head as a child. Instead, he had cheated death, and despite his gimp and speech impediment, lived a long life doing pretty much what he wanted. He hadn't drawn the best of cards, but had played his hand darned well. So what was there to grieve over? Dad left the Casey Ranch to Buster and the homestead on Salt Draw to me. But going through his papers, which was no small chore, I discovered that he owed thousands of dollars in back taxes on the Texas property. As Rosemary and I set out on the long drive back to Seligman, I considered our choices. Did we sell the land to pay off the taxes? Or did we keep it and pay the taxes by digging into the money we'd save to buy Hackberry? We were still stopping to beg for gas, and a couple of times I insisted Rosemary make the pitch. At first she was so embarrassed that she could barely get the words out, but I figured she needed to learn the art of persuasion, and by the end she was throwing herself into her performances with gusto, relishing the idea that even though she was just 12 years old, she could talk grown-up strangers into doing something for her. As a reward, I decided to make a detour up to Albuquerque so we could both see the Madonna of the Trail. The statue had been put up several years earlier, and I'd always wanted to have a look at it myself. It stood in a small park almost 20 feet high, a figure of a pioneer woman in a bonnet and brogans, holding a baby with one hand and a rifle with the other while a small boy clung to her skirts. I thought of myself as the sensible type, not given to a lot of sentimental blubbering, and most statues and paintings struck me as useless clutter, but there was something about the Madonna of the Trail that almost brought tears to my eyes. "It's kind of ugly," Rosemary said, "and the woman's a little scary." "Are you kidding?" I said. "That's art." When I returned to the ranch, Jim and I sat down to figure out what we should do about the West Texas land. Jim was of two minds, but for some reason, seeing that statue had made me hell-bent on holding on to the land Dad had homesteaded. For one thing, land was the best investment. Over the long haul, and provided you treated it with respect, land pretty much always rose in value. And while that West Texas land was definitely parched, they were drilling for oil all over the state. Dad's papers contained some correspondence with Standard Oil, and it might well be sitting on a big field of black gold. But Dad's West Texas land called to me for a deeper reason. Maybe it was the Irish in me, but everyone in my family, going back to my grandfather, he'd come over from County Cork, where all the land was owned by absentee palms who took most of what you grew, had always been obsessed with land. Now, for the first time in my life, I had the opportunity to own some outright. There was nothing to compare with standing on a piece of land you owned free and clear. No one could push you off it. No one could take it from you. No one could tell you what to do with it. The soil belonged to you, and so did every rock, every blade of grass, every tree, and all the water and minerals under the land all the way to the center of the earth. And if the world went to hell in a handbasket, as it seemed to be doing, you could say goodbye to everyone and retreat to your land, hunkering down and living off it. Land belonged to you and yours forever. "That's one unyielding patch of earth," Jim said. He argued that we couldn't raise much of a herd on 160 acres, and paying off those taxes would make a big dent in the fund to buy Hackberry. "We might not ever be able to buy Hackberry," I said. "This is a sure thing. I'm a gambler, but a smart one. And the smart gambler always goes for the sure thing." We paid off the taxes and became bona fide Texas land barons. I felt that the Madonna of the Trail would have approved. We usually took cattle to market in the spring and fall. But that year, the fall roundup was delayed until Christmas because, with the war going on, the military was using the railroad to ship troops and equipment all over the place, and that was the only time the train was available. But that also meant Rosemary, Little Jim, and I could pitch in, which worked out well because the war had created a shortage of cowboys. We usually had upward of 30 cowboys on a roundup, but that year we had half as many. Rosemary and Little Jim had both been going on roundups ever since they were old enough to walk, first riding behind me and Jim, then on their own ponies. Even so, Big Jim didn't want them in the thick of the drive, where even the best cowboys could get thrown off their horses and trampled by nervous cattle. So he had Rosemary and Little Jim work as outriders, chasing down strays and stragglers hiding in the draws. I followed the herd in the pickup, carrying the bedrolls and the grub. It was cold that December, and you could see steam rising off the horses as they cut back and forth, keeping the herd together while it moved across the range. Rosemary was riding Old Buck, the buckskin-colored Pershawn who was so smart that Rosemary could drop the reins and he'd corner strays on his own, biting them on the butt to drive them back to the herd. Rosemary loved the roundups except for one thing. She secretly rooted for the cattle. She thought they were kind, wise animals who, in their hearts, knew that you were leading them to their death, which was why their lowing had such a piteous tone. I suspected that from time to time, she'd help the odd steer escape. One day, well into the drive, Jim noticed a stray sidling up a draw and sent Rosemary after it. We heard Old Buck whinnying, but a little later, Rosemary rode back out all innocent-eyed, declaring she couldn't find the steer. "Just plain disappeared," she said, and held her hands up with a shrug. "It's a mystery." Jim shook his head and sent Fidel Hanna, a young Havasupai, into the draw. Soon enough, he came trotting out, driving the steer in front of him. Jim gave Rosemary a hard look. "What the hell are you doing?" he asked. "Not her fault, boss," Fidel Hanna said. "That steer, he was hiding way up in a gulch." Jim looked like he didn't completely buy the story, but it got Rosemary off the hook. Fidel glanced at Rosemary, and I saw him giving her a sly little wink. Rosemary had turned 13 that year, which put her right on the brink of womanhood. Girls of my generation sometimes got married at that age, and from that moment on, she was smitten with Fidel Hanna. He was only 16 or 17 himself, a tall, good-looking boy with an angular face who was moody and aloof, but also sweet. He had a languid way of moving, wore a black hat with a shiny silver concha, and rode like he was part of his horse. Rosemary by then was quite a looker, with her dark blonde hair, wide mouth, and saucy green eyes. But she seemed unaware of it, carrying on instead like a complete tomboy. Her crush on Fidel Hanna left her confused and acting slightly silly. During the day, he'd catch her gazing at him. She'd do things like challenge him to Indian wrestling matches, but she also made drawings of him on his horse and left them under his saddle at night. The other cowboys noticed and started ribbing Fidel Hanna. I figured I'd have to keep an eye on the situation. "Watch yourself around these cowboys," I told Rosemary. "What do you mean?" Rosemary asked, giving me that same innocent-eyed expression she'd given Jim when she couldn't find the stray. "You know what I mean." With demand for beef down because of the war, we rounded up only 2,000 head of cattle, not the usual 5,000. And when we put the herd together, we drove it east across the plateau to the loading pens in Williams. Once we got there, I saddled up Diamond, one of our quarter horses, to help out with the corralling and loading. Near the end, two steers ducked out of the chute and headed through an open gate toward the range.
"Go, babies, go!"
Rosemary shouted. I looked sharply at her, and she covered her mouth with her hand, which made me realize she hadn't even known what she was saying. She just blurted it out. Fidel Hanna and I chased the two runaways and drove them back to the chute, where they were loaded into the cattle cars with the rest of the herd. I trotted over to where Rosemary was sitting on Buck. "Didn't you tell me you wanted to live on the ranch when you grew up?" I asked. Rosemary nodded. "What in the Sam Hill do you think we do on ranches?"
"Raise cattle."
"Raise cattle for market, which means sending them off to be slaughtered. If that upsets you, if you're rooting for the cattle to break free, you're not cut out for ranch life." We got back to the ranch and were in the barn unsaddling the horses and cleaning tack when Rosemary walked up to Jim and me. "I want to learn to skin a steer," she said. "What on earth for?" I asked. "It's the nastiest job on the ranch," Jim said, "even worse than gelding." "Since I'm going to be a rancher, it's something I need to learn," Rosemary said. "Suppose you're right about that," Jim said. At roundup time, when we had a lot of cowboys on hand, we slaughtered a steer at least once a week. A few days later, Jim picked out a healthy-looking 3-year-old Hereford. He led it into the meat house, quickly slit its throat, gutted it, and hooked it. Then a couple of the cowboys used the pulley to hoist it up to the cross pole. We let the carcass hang for a day, and the following morning we all went back to the meat house for the butchering. Jim used the pedal-driven grinding stone to give the knife a razor-sharp edge, holding it with both hands and moving it back and forth along the spinning stone as sparks shot out. Rosemary, who was watching silently, looked pale. I knew she thought of cattle as sweet creatures who never harmed anyone, and now she was standing in front of a dead steer her father had killed, steeling herself to cut it apart. When I was growing up, gelding and slaughtering had been part of my life. But since moving to the ranch, we'd had the cowboys do the bloody work, and Rosemary had been shielded from it. But the kid was trying to be brave, and as Jim tied the leather butcher's apron around her waist, she started humming. Jim passed her the knife and guided her hand to the spot on the steer's lower leg where she needed to make the first cut. As she drew the knife down, she started crying silently, but she kept at it, Jim directing her movements, keeping his voice low and steady, cautioning her not to nick the flesh. Rosemary's hands were soon covered with blood, and she smeared it on her face, trying to wipe away the tears, but she never gave up. And while it took most of the day, they eventually got the hide off and sectioned the meat. When it was all done, I threw sawdust on the floor while Jim cleaned the tools. Rosemary hung up the leather apron, washed her hands in a bucket, and walked out of the meat house without saying a word. Jim and I looked at each other, but we didn't say anything either. We both knew that she'd proved she could do it, but she'd also proved that she truly didn't have the heart for it, and none of us ever mentioned it again. I thought Rosemary might have even lost her appetite for meat, but the girl had a real gift for pushing unpleasantness out of her mind, and that night she tucked into her steak with gusto. The following summer, I received a letter from Clarice Pearl, a senior muckety-muck with the Arizona Department of Education. She wanted to investigate the living conditions of the children of the Havasupai, who lived in a remote stretch of the Grand Canyon. She was bringing a nurse from Indian Affairs to determine if the children met hygiene standards. She asked me to drive the two of them to the canyon and arrange horses and a guide to get us down the long trail to the Havasupai village. Fidel Hanna, the young Havasupai ranch hand whom Rosemary had a crush on, lived in the reservation when he wasn't staying at the bunkhouse, and I asked him to set things up. He laughed and shook his head when I told him why the superintendent and nurse were making the trip. "Coming to inspect the savages?" he said. My father used to tell the story about how, for centuries, the Havasu men got up in the morning, spent the day hunting and fishing, came home, played with their children, and lay down with their women at night. They thought life was pretty good, but then the white man came along and said, "I have a better idea." "I get his point," I said, "but my father used to sit around pining for the past, too, and I've seen how that kind of thinking just eats away at you." I drove the hearse into Williams, bringing Rosemary with me, to pick up Miss Pearl and the nurse, Marion Finch, at the depot. Both of them were stout and pucker-mouthed, with short bobby-pinned hair. I recognized the type, disapproving do-gooders. They always had very high standards, and they always let you know that you didn't quite measure up to them. As we headed north, I tried to entertain my customers with a little Indian lore. Pai meant people, I explained. Havasupai meant people of the blue-green water. There were also the Yavapai, the sun people, and the Wallapai, the tall pine people. The Havasupai, who lived in a narrow valley on the banks of the Colorado River, regarded the water as sacred and threw their babies into it when they were 1.5 years old. "Before they've learned fear," I said. "That's just the kind of practice we're concerned about," Miss Finch said. I glanced over at Rosemary and rolled my eyes.